done a whole lot of speaking since I've been with you. Been in Texas, been in Honduras, and other places as well. And my staff has now got me trained to give an outline before I speak. So I think I'm going to start practicing that here in the class. And so this is kind of what I hope to achieve in the remainder of this class. Number one, I'll give you a brief report on the travels I've been doing and what we've learned from that. And then I want to talk about, I mean, whenever I'm gone this long, there's always amazing scientific discoveries. I'm going to limit it to just one. I really want to talk about two because it actually involves one of our Reasons to Believe scholars. He made an amazing discovery, got it published, but I'll save that for next time. Then we're also going to look at chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes. So those are the three things I hope to get accomplished today. See how far we get. Okay. Before I do that, though, this being Volunteer Sunday, I do want to thank the volunteers here. I would not be able to travel and speak like I do if it wasn't for the fact that we had people in this class, well-trained, able to teach in my stead. And I see all four of you here. There's Mark Durham in the front, got Dave Sargent back there. And over there, we have Ross Hoagland and Mark Perez. So thank all of you for teaching in my stead. All right. Thank you. And Peter, thank you for volunteering as well. And I know we used to have, who's the biologist used to teach here? But then now he's moved out to
Richard Dean.
Yeah, now he's out in the valley. So, I'm going to have you excuse me fairly soon after the class is over, because I'm going to be teaching at Bel Air Presbyterian this afternoon. I think it starts at 4:30, but they want me there nice and early to get set up. And we've got a lot of UCLA skeptics coming, so it should be fun. So,
what's the subject?
They've asked me to speak on cosmic reasons to believe in Jesus Christ. It's a talk where I don't use the Bible, just science alone, to go from atheism to deism, then I take it from deism to theism, then theism to Jesus Christ and the plan of salvation. And it works well on skeptics. I actually used it quite often when I was in Honduras. The whole idea that you can use the book of nature to actually get people to the foot of the cross. So,
is it a debate?
No, I'm speaking, then doing Q&A. So, and it's actually headed up by people that are part of our San Fernando Reasons to Believe chapter. There's a guy with a physics degree who's actually working in the entertainment industry, writing software for them. He's the one that's running the class. Perry Lanaro is the fellow. He does every week, but he's been having different scientists from Reasons to Believe show up and share with the skeptics there. So thank all of you. And, you know, Colleen manages a book table every week. So at the Skeptic Forum, too. So thank you, Colleen. So, yes?
I discovered that on Facebook a lot of these chapters for Reasons to Believe have their own discussion pages and pages. You might
they do.
Check them out.
Yep, and some amazing things happened with their chapters. Okay, quick report on what was going on. I was heading to Honduras to speak there for a week, but they had me land first in Houston, and I spoke at the church in Houston that basically was sponsoring the trip to Honduras. It's very charismatic and Pentecostal, and so they had me give the two main messages that I was going to be giving in Honduras. I was going to go to Honduras, six messages, and the translator said, please, cut it down to just two, three messages, because I got to translate all this. So, but they had me give the two primary messages when I was in Houston to the church that was sponsoring this. Actually, it was a denomination. There's a new denomination founded by Church on the Way, and they actually have over 1,000 churches worldwide now. So, what was surprising is that this is a church that really doesn't get much intellectual stimulation or science-faith issues, and so that when they heard the talks, they really came alive and just said, this is exactly what we need. And that was interesting because the missionaries that were going with me to Honduras were saying, we know that Honduras needs this, but hey, the U.S. and what they realize, no, this is a real need also in the United States. So I got a very enthusiastic reaction. A whole lot of people signed up to join the Houston chapter. And then we caught the plane the next day for Honduras. Well, I don't know Spanish. I mean, I went to a school in Vancouver, British Columbia, and our high school offered 8 different foreign languages that you could take. You could take German, you could take Russian, you could take French, Latin you could take, Chinese you could take, Japanese you could take, a few other languages, but no Spanish. The reason why, there weren't any Spanish speakers in Vancouver at that time. So there was no Spanish. So my Spanish is basically limited to taco and burrito. So
the essentials.
The essentials, right. But my translator, he was a fellow who grew up in Honduras. In fact, I wound up staying with his brother. And he pastors a church in Tampa. So he's definitely bilingual. And with him, I was able to take all my keynote messages. I put them all in Spanish. I put the English that I needed in the notes where the people couldn't see it, but everything was in Spanish. And that really helped. Because I was thinking we could use 2 projectors, and they said the technology won't make that work in Honduras. We did do that.
Were you on radio there?
I was scheduled to be on a radio show and a TV show, both of which never happened. But that actually gave us opportunity to do other things. My first event was with 300 pastors and missionaries, all of them people, native Hondurans. And they had me speak on science and Genesis. And the pastors afterwards basically said, this is exactly what we need. This is something that we get tripped up on all the time. And we don't have good answers. And then they said, could you please come back to Honduras? We need to have a whole weekend where you and could you bring another scientist with you from Reasons to Believe? This is exactly what the pastors in Honduras need. That was a surprise to the missionaries. They figured, Hugh, you're primarily here to speak to the university people and the business leaders and the politicians. But when they saw the response of the pastors, that got them really excited. And several of the pastors want me to meet with the president. They think he's a deist, but they'd like him to really become a full-on Christian. So.
Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Well, you know him better than I do. Good. Okay. So my second event was on SPEC. We went to a socialist university. Interestingly, in Honduras, all the universities are in one city. So I didn't have to travel outside the city. If anybody wants to go to university, it's the second largest city. And I heard it's the safest. No, it starts with a T. That's it? That's it? You got it? All right. So, all the universities are there, and they said, the university we really have not been able to touch at all was the big socialist university. And they said, we mean socialist, what we really mean is communist. So he says, all the professors there are part of the Socialist Party, and they're pretty militant atheists, and they basically said, you might be able to speak, you might not be able to speak. So I basically met with some professors, and they wanted to look at my keynote message first and go through all my slides, because it says, we don't want religion here, but when they saw all the science built in, basically it was a talk I'm going to be giving at Bel Air this afternoon. They said, you can give this talk. But they said, don't expect people to ask any questions. This is Honduras. People don't ask questions. At best, you get them to write out a question. And what they were telling me is that there's a culture there where you don't want to be embarrassed. So everybody's afraid to ask a question because they think they'll look stupid or look embarrassed. So I said, okay, we'll let them do written questions. However, what was interesting is when we came to the Q&A time, hands went up. And the professor says, we've never seen. In fact, what he told me, he says, you better speak for the whole hour because there won't be any questions. But I stopped at 38 minutes. I was prepared to keep going. I said, I'm going to stop here just because I think some of you might have questions. And immediately, and the professors were stunned. They said, we've never seen this before.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
You know, God is moving through your ministry. I was impressed on in an improbable planet where you have the liner notes or the forewords, and Pat Robertson was going along with your points of view now. So.
Yeah, he's a big supporter. He is.
Yeah, and he has influence, so God is moving.
Okay, then next talk was at the Maine University. It has 125,000 students. So, in fact, we had to walk for over a mile just to get to the place where I was speaking after we had parked the car. And there again, they said, you know, we're not sure that we're going to let you speak here. Again, it was in spec, and they just told me we've not been able to get into the universities.
What do you mean so, by spec?
They wanted to see, they said, look, we're not going to let you speak until we actually vet you. And so... And this was the Space Sciences Department. It's basically physics, astronomy, and geophysics and planetary science. And I knew of the university because I've actually read some of their research papers that came out of that department. But yeah, these physics and astronomy professors, again, looked at all my slides because their big concern is, hey, you're a missionary from the U.S. Look, this is an academic institution. And we don't want somebody here just preaching. This is a place where it's got to be science. But they looked at my stuff and they said, okay, we'll let you speak. But again, as I noticed the speaking, as that my translator said, they're suspicious of your qualifications to speak on astrophysics. But after they heard me speak, their hands went up. And the students had a hard time asking questions because the professors were so aggressive on trying to ask questions. And then it segued where they were asking my counsel on their different research projects. And so the missionaries who says, we're in at this campus. This is exactly what we needed to break through at this campus. Because it says, yeah, their big concern is, you know, we bring a Christian on board. Are they really going to be academically qualified? Yes.
Jordan Peterson at University of Toronto, he's gotten famous lately. He's into social science as a psychologist. But he's recently stated that he feels that atheism has gotten so popular in the university specifically because of Marxism, that the social sciences have actually percolated down into the actual sciences. And he's a Christian. I don't really understand his metaphysics. He's pretty obscure about them. But I wanted to ask you what you think of that general theory that Marxism has, you know.
Well, Marxism has had a big influence in large parts of Central America and Latin America as well. So yeah, you do run into that. It's much more prevalent in the social science departments than it is, say, in the physical sciences. But yeah, I mean, even at the socialist university, the fellow who taught physics there was definitely a socialist. So, and mainly because that's all the people that the university recruits. And to a lesser degree, that's happening here in the U.S. and Canada. Because, I mean, basically the professors that are there recruit the new professors. And they have a certain worldview. They tend to recruit people with the same worldview. So it's one reason why we've established the lab at Reasons to Believe. It's basically a mentoring program for young people who want to pursue advanced degrees in science and engineering because we feel it's important that the Christian community be encouraging this. I saw this at the first church I spoke in Houston. It's like, I mean, a lot of what was going on is discouraging Christian young people from pursuing STEM careers because they think it might be dangerous for their faith. And what we really need to do is encourage them to go into the STEM careers so we can actually have evangelists there in the different STEM disciplines.
Are there any Christian universities in Honduras?
Well, the universities I spoke at were not, that there might be, I just don't know. There are a lot of Christians in Honduras. I'd say the per capita Christians is much higher than here in the U.S. But the reason why they brought me to Honduras is they said we see very little evidence of Christianity amongst the business owners, the university people, and the politicians. And so that's mainly what they did is have me come speak to those groups.
The Catholic Church is probably pretty strong there, huh?
Actually, they say that the Catholic Church was very strong, but they estimate that the number of evangelical Protestant Christians is about half of the total number of people who identify themselves as Christians.
So it's increasing.
It's increasing. Guatemala, they say it's 80%.
But
in Honduras, it's above 50.
Sean was mentioning about the Marxism. You know, I found that there's the atheists, and then there's anti-theists that are very militant, and that's a big problem, I think.
That's what I refer to as the new atheists. The old atheists were people who say, we want the rest of you to tolerate us, and you know, don't get on our case for not believing in God. The new atheists are aggressive. They're anti-theists. In fact, Lawrence Krauss describes himself as not as an atheist, but as an anti-theist.
Yeah.
And basically, they look at people who believe in God as being fundamentally evil, and we need to root this archaic idea of God out of the American culture. No longer is it, you know, we want to be tolerated, we want to take over. So, but these people can be won for Christ. So, I mean, a couple of people were part of the new atheists. I had an opportunity to debate them, and it was amazing how receptive they were. It's just that you got to use the right approach. So, okay, my next event was with the equivalent of the Honduran Pentagon. The military used to run the country. They now have a civil government, but the military is still very prominent in Honduras. And there are some Christians in the military. And the military used to be extremely corrupt. It's no longer as corrupt as it was, mainly because some of the top generals are believers. And so they offered me to speak at their military place. They had about 100 senior officers show up. And, you know, it's interesting. In Honduras, nobody shakes hands. They hug you. So when you get met by a stranger, first thing they do is they hug you. And then when you're about to leave, they hug you again. And that includes generals and police officers. So I think this is a joke, but they say if you ever get a traffic ticket in Honduras, the cop hugs you first, writes out a ticket, then he hugs you again and waves you on your way.
You get arrested, they hug you.
I think that's apocryphal, but I mean, it is true. Every day I got hugged about 150 to 200 times. So literally everybody hugs you. Oh, yes, the food, although you have to watch the water there. So often when they took me out for food, we went to Denny's. That's one of the high-end restaurants in Honduras. So, all the fast food places we have here, they exist there. But, I mean, that's a place where you know at least the water is safe and you're not going to get sick on their salads. So, but also got to eat at private homes. So, and then I had a private meeting with the chief of police, well, private with me and the missionaries that were with me. And the new chief of police there is a strong believer. And he says, of all the institutions in Honduras, the police is the most corrupt of all. And he was telling me what happened when he took the post of chief of police. He says one of the top drug lords visited him and said, $5 million is yours if you look the other way. And if you don't, we'll kill you. So there's your choice. Take $5 million or you're going to be dead. And he says, well, you know I'm a believer that this isn't going to work. And he says, you'll be dead within 24 hours. So he got a bunch of people to pray. And what happened is in less than 24 hours, that drug lord was extradited to the U.S. So he survived. He's been in his post now for more than a year. He has threats on his life on a weekly basis, but God's protecting him. But he says, the thing that grieves him the most is how many Christian police officers and Christian business owners come and try to bribe him. And he says, every time I sit them down and says, how can you call yourself a follower of Jesus Christ and try to do this? If we're going to turn this country around and really turn it into a God-fearing nation. And his whole point is the Honduran economy would just take off and catapult if they would simply get the corruption under control. I mean, it's a beautiful country. It'd be an incredible tourist place. I mean, as it is, tourism is one of their big industries. But I said, if we could just get the corruption under control, the economy, literally, would take off. because the people are highly educated, so there's a lot of that. The labor pool there really could do a lot.
I hear there are stations on radio.
Yes, there are. They have Christian radio there.
Yeah, I listen to on my internet radio, the Evangelical Voice of Honduras, which is HRBC, to call letters.
Okay, my next meeting was with business and political leaders. And what happened is the churches in Honduras basically sponsored a really elegant dinner that they went at the downtown part of the city, and they invited all these business owners and political leaders to come. There were over 100 that showed up. And again, people told me, you know, this is Honduras. People aren't going to ask questions. But the Q&A time went on for an hour and a half. And yeah, people did hand in cards. In fact, I wound up taking about 400 cards home from Honduras with questions on them, all in Spanish, of course. And what they begged me is, please translate them and answer them all. I said, 400 questions. That's a lot of questions to answer in writing.
Were they a wide-ranging topics? Or?
Well, we got a person translating them right now, but they said it's going to be a big job answering all those questions. So I'm probably going to be looking for some help because there's no way I got time to do all that, but I'll answer some of them. Basically, what I'm looking for is a crew to answer the questions, and the ones that they have trouble with, they can bring them back to me, and I'll work with the translator. So, but yeah, I mean, what my missionary friends told me is that we've never seen such willingness to engage in Q&A. So typically, when we've had Americans come, they speak, and everybody's quiet. And says, or sometimes we get them to write out cards, but even that is difficult. Yes?
Is there any younger theology there, Hugh, that you
have? Yes, there is younger theology there. Everywhere I spoke, including even at the Pentagon at the universities, I was getting young earth questions. The difference was I didn't see any anger or animosity being directed towards me. They're simply asking questions. So, yeah, it's a big influence there. But the pastors especially said this, you know, I was very impressed with the 300 pastors because they were basically saying, you know, this has been a problem in our country. What you're offering is the way to go. If we're ever going to be able to reach the educated people here. And they said, that's what's happening in Honduras because of all the universities they've invested in. People are getting, a lot of people have bachelor's degrees and beyond. So he says, yeah, we need a different way of approaching these science faith issues. And the fact that they're so eager to have us come back and do a full-on conference, I think tells you that I think we can, and maybe that could help what's going on here in the U.S., if we can get, say, Latin America turned around on this young earth, old earth issue, that might actually encourage people here to think it through as well. So then I flew back to Austin and did an event in a church in Austin. It's a new church, and they have three different campuses. So I spoke at the north campus, but they have a south campus and a central campus. And, you know, they use the latest technology, so I was able to speak on all three campuses, even though it was only at one, for about 4,000 people. Our Austin chapter was there, and they said it was 20 deep at the book tables. And again, what I heard from the pastors is really the first message they've ever had on a science faith topic. They weren't sure the congregation was going to respond. But yeah, the first time I spoke, it was a standing ovation that went on for about 5 minutes. So the pastors there said, wow, we had no idea. And what's fun about the church, half the adults there are people who have only been Christians in the last 5 years. So the church is filled with adult converts. This is, we don't grow through transfers, we grow through conversions. So, And it all ended where they said, we want you guys to come back, bring the rest of your scientists. We want a whole weekend conference here. And they heard about the lab. They said, this is Austin. There's all kinds of university students here who really need the lab experience. You guys come, do a conference. We'll promote the lab, and we'll fill up the lab just with people here in Austin. So very enthusiastic group there. And if you're wondering where I was the Sunday after that, I was doing a retreat for the disciples class at Lake Avenue Congregational. And, you know, the leaders talked to me and they said, we do a retreat every year. But the scientists and engineers in our class have basically had it with messages that were just the same old stuff. They said they really want an intellectual challenge. So I said, we don't want you to softball your messages. This is a class filled with physicists and JPL engineers. And so in fact, I think I see one of the, you were there.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to have you come up. Why don't you give a report? But I'll tell you what happened is my wife was saying, Hugh, all these engineers and scientists have spouses that are not engineers and scientists. What about them? Well, why don't you tell them what happened?
Well, it was, I think the attendance was probably about 130 people, spouses and, couples and also some singles. And Hugh gave a great, great series. It was it was wonderfully received. I talked to some of the people about it, and, I was expecting there would be some young Earth people and that they might be, resistant. But no, they were really, really just very, very, very encouraged. Yeah. So I was encouraged as well.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, Kathy was with me too, and she said, I talked to the spouses. They loved it just as much as the physicists and the engineers. So, and we're hoping this is going to open up some doors for ministry with the other part of the Lake Avenue community. And heard a wonderful testimony there from a lady, fairly new Christian. She'd been following Buddhism for about 20, 25 years, I think. And she told her story of how after being a practicing Buddhist, very faithful, for over a two-decade period, she woke up one morning and said, I've been doing this for 20-plus years. I'm still empty.
Yeah.
There's a God out there, but I haven't found him yet. So she says, you just prayed. God, if you're there, please reveal yourself. And she ran into a believer, got a Bible, started reading it, turned her whole life around, gave her life to Christ, went back to all of her Buddhist friends and says, I finally found life. I found Jesus. And they're all saying, oh, no. But she's continuing to witness to them, saying, hey, this is the real God, the one that really has created everything. Okay. I want to make sure I got time to get into Ecclesiastes 8. So this is the new discovery I want to talk to you about. And there's an article coming out my Facebook page tomorrow on it, so if you want the details, but I'm just going to give you a quick run through. And this is the recognition that, every planet in our solar system makes it possible for humans to live on planet Earth. It'd be one thing if God wanted a place where you could have a few bacteria running around. But if you want plants, if you want animals, and especially if you want human beings, you need Venus to be exactly the way it is, Mercury, Uranus, Neptune, etc. And the team that's been most responsible for this is a team out of Nice, France. They call themselves the Nice team, but it involves people all around the world. But the guy that heads it up is at the observatory in Nice, France, Alessandro Morbidelli. And he's the one that's been leading a team of people trying to figure out how you can begin with the sun and its protoplanetary disk and wind up with the eight planets that we have. And literally, this has been a project that's been going on for 150 years. And it was his team that finally solved it. And one of the big problems was, yes, we can figure out how gas giant planets form, but how do you get the rocky planets? Because all the models that have been done up until this Nice team got working on it basically said the rocky planets will get progressively larger and larger as you go from the sun out towards the gas giants. And so that works for Mercury. It's the smallest of the rocky planets. Venus is next. You've got Earth, although the models predicted that Earth should be bigger than what it is. But they said, now you've got Mars, and all the models predicted there'd be a really big planet between Mars and Jupiter. Instead, you got a bunch of asteroids there. And really not that much in the way of asteroids. So this was the problem. And they also discovered in the process, if you had a big planet where Mars is and an even bigger planet where the asteroid belt is, there'd be no way you could have advanced life on planet Earth. because having massive planets that close to the Earth would disturb the orbit of the Earth sufficiently as to rule out the possibility of advanced life, and would also actually funnel a lot of the collision events in towards the Earth. And so it was something called the Grand Tack, where, well, let me get this up here for you. I think I've shown this to you before, about a year and a half ago. And the model basically says that it only works in a planetary system where the biggest of the gas giant planets is closest to its host star. And where it has more mass than the rest of the planets combined, it also only works where the second biggest planet is the next closest gas giant to its host star. So you have to have Jupiter closest to the host star, and you need Saturn, the next biggest planet, farther away. And it's crucial that Jupiter have more mass than the rest of the planet. In fact, it has to have at least twice as much mass as the rest of the planets combined for this to work. Because what they discovered is, you know, we look at all these planets that we discovered outside the solar system, and right now the list stands at 3,610 planets that have been discovered outside of our solar system. Pretty amazing when you consider 20 years ago the list was zero. It's now up to 3,610. But if you look at that, and by the way, it's easy to see that. Simply go to Exoplanet Catalog on your search engine. It'll pop up a catalog of all 3,610. If you look at that catalog, you'll notice it's dominated by gas giant planets. But almost all those gas giant planets, in fact, all of them either orbit their host stars much closer than Jupiter orbits our star, the Sun, or they orbit much farther away than Neptune. What's unusual is that we've got these four gas giants that are not too close to their host stars and not too far away. Yeah.
Is that 3,000 confirmed?
3,610 confirmed. Okay. There's a couple of thousand candidates, and the belief is that probably 80% of those candidates will prove to be false positives. So the list, until they get another telescope orbiting in outer space, they're probably not going to get too many more. Yeah, John. Okay. When they discovered these 3,610 planets, what they notice is the vast majority of the gas giant planets orbit interior to the orbit of Mars. And some of them orbit interior to the orbit of Mercury. And we know that gas giant planets can't form close to their host stars. They have to form beyond what's called the snow line. That's the distance from the host star where carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and water are permanently in the frozen state. So you can't get a gas giant planet to form unless it's really cold out there. However, the fact that we see all these gas giant planets in so close means that they migrated inwards. And to answer your question, thanks to the research on these extrasolar planets, we now know what makes them migrate. What makes them migrate inward is that these gas giant planets form first, but there's still lots of leftover debris from the protoplanetary disk. Lots of rocks, lots of boulders, and lots of asteroids and comets, and bodies they call planetesimals, which are basically bodies that are 1,000 kilometers across or bigger. And what happens is the gas giant planets gravitationally interact with the leftover debris from planetary formation, and it causes them to move towards their stars. And they literally can move so close that they're only orbiting a million or 2 miles away from their host stars. We see a lot, they call those hot Jupiters. They're orbiting so close to their stars that they're blazing hot on their surface. Now, about 5% of the gas giant planets, however, we see orbiting their stars much farther away than the gas giants in our solar system. And what's happened there is that the planets formed and gobbled up all the planetesimals, rocks, dust, and so there was nothing to interact with, which means they didn't drift at all. What's different about our solar system is that the gas giant planets moved towards their host stars, stopped, and reversed direction. And it only works if you have the biggest of the gas giant planets having more than twice the mass of all the rest of the planets combined, where the second biggest gas giant planet is the next closest to the star. Because what causes it to reverse is you've got Jupiter moving in towards the Sun, and you've got Saturn moving in towards the Sun, but you're going to have the leftover debris from planetary formation more concentrated at the orbit of Saturn than the orbit of Jupiter. And that causes Saturn to move towards the Sun at a faster rate than Jupiter does. They're both moving towards the Sun, but Saturn moves at a faster rate. And there reaches a point where for every orbit of Saturn, Jupiter makes exactly two orbits.
Exactly.
And so you get what's called a 1-2 mean motion resonance. And that changes the dynamics with the planetesimals and causes all four gas giant planets to move outward. So that causes them to reverse direction. And also what happens when it hits that 1-2 resonance, and let me add this caveat. The latest development on this Grand Tack model says it's a 3-2 mean motion resonance rather than a 1-2. A 3-2 is where you got Jupiter making exactly three orbits for every two orbits of Saturn. But that also means you're going to have Jupiter and Saturn lining up relative to the Sun quite frequently as they orbit about the Sun. And when they do that, it destabilizes the solar system, causing the gas giant planets to reverse their migration direction, but it also obliterates 99.9% of all the asteroids and comets. And that was a major revelation, because we now have the telescope power to see asteroid and comet belts around nearby stars, and most of them have no asteroids or comets at all. And that's because if you've got gas giant planets migrating towards a star to a greater degree than what happened in our solar system, it eradicates all the asteroid and comet belts. They get completely eliminated from that planetary system. Now, the 5% where there's no migration at all, basically the comet and asteroid belts remain in their primordial state. What does that mean? They have asteroid and comet belts 1,000 times bigger than we see in our solar system. Now, you can imagine what life would be like if we had 1,000 times more asteroids and comets. You can also imagine what life would be like if they were closer, because that's the other thing. With the reversal of direction, it causes the asteroid and comets to move outward. So they move away to a safer place relative to the Earth, and you wind up having 99.9% of all the asteroids and comets either being absorbed by the Sun or being blasted into interstellar space. Now, again, when we look at these asteroid and comet belts of other stars, they either have none at all, that's the vast majority, or they got comet and asteroid belts that are really, really big. Ours is the only one that's got five small asteroid and comet belts. Now, you might say, it might be nice if we didn't get hit at all by asteroids and comets. But we actually need a small delivery of asteroids and comets. In fact, I talked about this at one of the two skeptics forums. I forget which one. If you don't have a small delivery, you're not going to be able to keep the planet at a constant water level, because our planet Earth actually loses a small amount of water to interstellar space. Why? Our gravity is barely strong enough to hang on to water. And so we lose a tiny amount over the billions of years. But the amount we lose is replaced by comets. Comets are 85% frozen water. So if you get a small comet being absorbed into the atmosphere of the Earth, it puts more water in the atmosphere, and a lot of that water winds up in the ocean. The other thing that we get a benefit from is that when we hit asteroids hitting us, sometimes they give us really valuable ores. And so I mentioned one of the skeptics forum. There's a big asteroid that collided just off of Lake Superior. in a place called Sudbury, Ontario. Half the world's nickel that's in circulation comes from that one mine. And basically, they're mining an asteroid. And likewise, 80% of the gold that's in circulation in industrial America and around the world comes from an asteroid that landed just outside of Johannesburg. So you want to know why so much gold comes from South Africa? Because that's where an asteroid hit. So, matter of fact, NASA, this just came out from JPL a few months ago, they found an asteroid that they estimate has a value of $50 quadrillion because of the concentrated metal ores. They think there's platinum there. All these valuable metals are sitting there in that asteroid. And so they actually are seriously thinking, wouldn't it be great? Now, that asteroid tends to be a bit big, so it'd be expensive to draw it in, but there's got to be more that are smaller. They love to grab one that's, say, about a mile in diameter and tow it in and then make a lot of money off of it. You know, you might laugh at this, but NASA's already calculated that in terms of trying to get those metals out of the dirt of the Earth, I mean, our planet Earth is filled with lots of valuable ores, but they're hard to get out of the ground. The thing about these asteroids, there's no rust. You're basically getting pure metals right out of the asteroid. And so they actually claim it would bring the cost of those precious metals down to less than 10% of what we're paying for them right now. So, mind you, there's always the risk that you might not calculate the orbit accurately enough. So, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, you showed this slide at the Skeptics Forum, which is the answer to my question, which you haven't brought up, is what's amazing when I've studied these exoplanets, is besides all the benefits that you give, is extraticity. Out of those, all those 3,000, more than 3,000 exoplanets, if the planet is too close, it's tidally locked. It has a circular orbit, but it's tidally locked, which is useless because of the size of the cold. And then the other planets that are either near Earth's orbit or beyond, their extraticity is huge. They all look like Pluto. And so the amazing thing about all these and our rocky planets is their near circular orbit. That just stands out like a huge sore thumb. So, I mean, between the stability of our star, the sun, at 0.1%, and everything else we see is maybe 2-3 or up to 40% stability, and the circular orbits, just those two parameters mean that we're alone in the universe.
Okay, what I'm going to do...
There are like hundreds of parameters, but just those two alone really eliminate everything.
And all this has happened since the Skeptics Forum. What's happened since the Skeptics Forum, two papers have been published, basically improving the Grand Tack model. And the goal was, the Grand Tack model has got so much design built into it, we need to redo the model and see if we can lower all this fine-tuning design. But what happened is, they now have even more fine-tuning design. And one of the things is exactly what you mentioned. You can't get circular orbits of either the terrestrial rocky planets, you know, namely Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Earth, and get circular orbits of the gas giant planets unless you've got this Grand Tack. Without the Grand Tack, it won't happen. You're going to wind up with these highly elliptical orbits, and that rules out the possibility of advanced life in the system.
And just to be clear, why is that when you're elliptical, the planet will be too far away and be totally frozen, and then as it gets closer to the sun, any water there would turn into steam.
Right.
And so a lot of times, I think it's Dormammu has talked about this, that it's very deceiving that a lot of the reports when they talk about these habitable planets, what they're doing is taking the mean diameter of these ones and saying that it's habitable, when in reality it has liquid water for maybe just a few days as it gets in the right spot. But most of the time it's either steam or frozen. And it's very dishonest because they don't put time in that element. They take a snapshot of the planet exactly at the good spot. But if you add the element of time, most of the time, it's not in a habitable zone.
Right. Dishonest. Yeah. Yeah, so our distance relative to our star, the sun, only varies by about 1 million miles because our orbit is almost perfectly circular. And that's true of every planet except Mercury. Mercury has an elliptical orbit, but it's so tiny and so close to the sun, it doesn't have any impact. But that's the second problem with elliptical orbits. If you've got a planet that has a very elliptical orbit, it's going to disturb the orbits of other planets in the same system.
They all have to be circular.
They all have to be circular unless they're really tiny and close to their stars or very far away and really tiny, which would be the case of Pluto. It's got an elliptical orbit, but it's so tiny it can't do anything. Likewise, Mercury is so tiny it can't do anything. All the rest of them have to be circular. But yeah, what they discovered in these two papers that were published this past week, it only works if you got this grand tack, and it only works too if you got Saturn moving at a much higher velocity than Jupiter, and having Saturn and Jupiter move at higher velocities than Uranus and Neptune. It also only works if the planetary system begins with five gas giants. And so the latest wrinkle in the model says you need two gas giants. They've redefined it. They call Jupiter and Saturn gas giants because they're 90 times the mass of the Earth or more, and they come up with another term that they call ice giants, which refers to Uranus and Neptune that are only about 15 to 20 times the mass of the Earth. But yeah, to make the model work, where you get these circular orbits and you actually wind up with a planet at Mars's distance that's as small as Mars, is you need a fifth planet. You need another ice giant. And so the solar system actually began with three Neptune-sized planets. One got kicked out, two remain. And the model doesn't work unless it begins with three of those ice giant planets. And
they work out where the fifth one would be on this chart?
Well, the fifth one either got totally ejected from the solar system into interstellar space, or it got ejected about 50 times farther away from the sun than where Neptune now orbits, so somewhere around 150 billion miles away.
But it has an influence, right?
Well, there are a number of astronomers. In fact, there's a couple of astronomers at Caltech who said, we're seeing an overlap of orbits of distant asteroids and comets in the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt. And we said, we think that's being caused by an ice giant planet that's orbiting very far away. And this model actually says that might happen. Yes? Okay, well, there's speculation on this, but they, because I mean, the planet formation models basically predict you should get a really big planet, much bigger than the Earth, but not as big as Neptune, at where the asteroid belt is right now. And so some thinking is that planet got shattered by a gravitational interaction with Jupiter and Saturn. And so the reason why you have these pure heavy metals in some of the asteroids is that would be the core of the body. So, for example, in the core of the Earth, you've got a lot of nickel, iron, and cobalt. And some of these asteroids, in fact, meteorites, a lot of the 25% of the meteorites are basically stainless steel. They're pure stainless steel. In fact, what's amazing is there are better grades of stainless steel than what you can buy from an iron smelter. And that's how the Eskimos, for example, were able to develop metal tools. They would go around in the wintertime and look for rocks, and they said, well, if there's rocks there, they have to be meteorites, and they would look for the 25% that were a really high grade of stainless steel, and they would use those to make knives and other tools. So the Eskimos have been doing that for thousands of years. A whole technology based on these stainless steel meteorites. Okay, a little bit off the topic, but go ahead.
Bottom line for this is, for, you know, like, if you're constructing a book, Astrobiology for Dummies, is that the universe is not only fine-tuned, but there, that strongly points towards the God of the Bible, or at least the God in general, because it's just so amazingly fine-tuned. You're saying that there's orbits that are exactly twice, well, the orbit of another planet. I'm not an astronomer, but I'm hearing what you're saying. Just don't remember it.
Well, here's the reason why it works. If you've got Saturn moving towards the sun at a faster velocity than Jupiter, it's inevitable that you'll reach one of those mean motion resonances, either a 1-2 resonance or a 3-2 resonance. And either way, it's going to change the whole dynamics of the system. But it only works if you've got the nearest planet with more mass than the rest of them by at least a factor of two, where the second biggest is the next closest. That's the only way it works.
It is
amazing.
It's a scientific term. It's amazing.
Well, okay, I could take it one step farther.
It's a theological term.
We not only see amazing design in the universe, we see amazing design in our cluster of galaxies. We see amazing design in our galaxy. We see amazing design in our solar system. We see amazing design in our star, our moon, and this is telling us all the planets.
Hello.
Okay.
Hello.
All right. Yeah. Let me finish this because it looks like I'm not going to get to... Okay. Yeah, I really want to wrap up what was in these two papers that got published these last few days, is that this Grand Tack model predicted all the details with great accuracy that we see in our present solar system, with one exception. They're able to predict, for example, that the main belt of asteroids would have started off with asteroids all the way interior to the orbit of Mars. And if it remained that way, advanced life would not be possible on the Earth. We'd be getting clobbered way too frequently by collisions with main belt asteroids. But it was thanks to this Grand Tack that the inner half of the main belt of asteroids got totally eradicated, and the part that was close to Jupiter got really thinned out. But that also explains why we have the orbits of these main belt asteroids. And really, this is a misnomer. They call it the main belt, but it's actually the smallest of the five belts of asteroids and comets in our solar system. But it was the first one discovered, so that's why they call it the main belt. But the orbits of these main belt asteroids have a huge variation in the tilt of the orbit relative to the plane of the solar system. And this model explained that beautifully, but it couldn't explain the eccentricities. And so what got published this week is the team out of Nice, France, redid the model where they said, you know, we're going to actually take our calculations, not just through this phase here. What you notice here is they cover about 600,000 years of history. They said, we're going to go forward another almost 4 billion years. They took it right up to the present. So it was a massive computer problem, but they did it. They now have the Grand Tack model worked out all the way through to the present moment. And when they did that, they were able to explain the distribution of eccentricities, the elliptical shapes of the main belt asteroids. And then another team, totally independent of the French team, looked at this model. Both papers got published in the same week. Looked at this model and said, okay, what the French did not do, well, actually it was an international team, they didn't fully take into account the viscosity of the pre-planetary proto-solar disk. Well, they did, but they said, we're going to do it more accurately. And when they did, they discovered that they get a different point where the planets, gas giant planets, come towards the sun and reverse. And so what you see here is the reversal point. An astronomical unit is a distance that the Earth is from the sun. Basically, they got these gas giant planets coming all the way into where the orbit of the Earth is, then reversing. And that would cause problems, both for the orbit of Mars and the orbit of Earth. And so the Nice team redid it and said, we think it's actually about 1.5 times the distance where it turns around. But this other team said, no, it's closer to 2.0. And this still explains all the properties of the main belt asteroid. In fact, explains it in more detail with greater precision. But also you get a turnaround point that would explain why the Earth has such a circular orbit, why it has the mass that it does, and why Mars is as small as it is and orbiting where it is. Basically, every detail you would care to raise up is now explained by this model in detail, which is very disappointing for the non-theists, because they're hoping that they could eliminate some of the fine-tuning design. They're winding up with a whole lot more fine-tuning design than what they thought. But yeah, it's a tremendous success for the Grand Tack model, and shows you why our solar system is unique, why we're not likely to ever find another planetary system like ours. And that was remarkable because back in 1995, when they first started finding these planets, they said, we're going to find all kinds of planetary systems that are carbon copies of our solar system. Not only has that not happened, we've discovered none of these extrasolar planetary systems are anything like the characteristics of our planetary system. Moreover, none of the planets that we've found in these extrasolar planetary systems are like any of the planets in our solar system. They all have features that are different. As I mentioned before in this class, the one that's touted all the time, Upsilon Andromeda E, it's got the same mass as Jupiter, the same orbital distance, the same orbital shape, but it's not the biggest planet in its system. It's about the same mass as Jupiter, but it's accompanied by two other planets in the same system that come in at 14 and 10 times the mass of Jupiter and are orbiting about where Venus and Mars are orbiting, which means forget about any kind of life. You're not even going to get bacteria as a possibility in that system. So I see I'm 5 minutes over, so I'm going to close in prayer. I'll stay around for a few questions, but then I got to get ready for my event at Bel Air. Father in heaven, we thank you for the amazing age in which we live. We're literally in the space of just a few days since the Skeptics Forum, we actually have a stronger case for you, God, personally designing every planet in our solar system, every asteroid and comet belt, to make it possible for us to enjoy this planet Earth with its population, with its beauty, and with the technology that we get to enjoy. Father in heaven, I pray that we'd wisely use all these resources that you've made available for us. Lord, help us to discover the purpose for which you created us individually, and Lord, give us the motivation and the energy and the resources to fulfill the specific purpose for which you created us. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.